You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
Following the government announcing its plan to improve school attendance rates, I spoke to experts in the education sector about their thoughts on this proposal. First, I spoke to Professional Teaching Fellow in Education and Social Work at the University of Auckland, Dr. Brian Marsh, about what factors are responsible for low truancy rates in the past few years. Here is that interview. As someone with extensive experience in education, what are your thoughts on the government's proposal to increase school attendance?
I think any proposal to increase school attendance is an excellent idea. My concern about the specific traffic light proposal, the red, yellow, green proposal, is that I can't see that there is there are plans for extra resource to be put into dealing with the students whose names will go forward to the Ministry of Education. At the moment, it seems that the red flag students' names will be put forward, but I can't see in the plan that there is resource for resolving the issue. So we're going to identify the students, but the question that sits in my head is, what are we going to do about it when we know who they are?
What issues do you believe are responsible for low attendance rates, particularly post-COVID-19?
Yeah, well, post-COVID-19 is the point, I think. One of the things that's happened in the post-COVID era, one of the things that the lockdown did, was to kind of burst the bubble around school, really. So school suddenly moved from being compulsory to an optional, maybe not kind of arrangement. We had emergency remote learning as a substitute. Our students stayed home for often quite extended periods. And I think that kind of ruptured the social contract, if you like, between students and school. Suddenly school wasn't as compulsory as it had been. And some of those students are proving hard to get back into the classroom.
Part of the government's traffic light proposal for attendance would be fining parents. What impact do you believe this would have?
Well, I'm not sure that it's going to have very much impact at all, actually. I think what we need to do is explore whereabouts the low rates of attendance are taking place, in which schools they are taking place, and what kind of communities are experiencing this. I was reading an article written in 2022 by some of my university colleagues that was looking at the notion of students who struggle in schools when many of their classmates move on. So it was about the transient population in New Zealand schools and looking at this as a social and relationship issue for the students left behind. Now, if transients, and the article made the point that transience is more prevalent in lower socioeconomic communities, and that compared to other OECD countries, New Zealand has a very high rate of mobility in our secondary school population. Now, if that's one of the things that lies behind low rates of attendance, then the issue is kind of a social and relationship one. Kids are moving schools, but probably the decision to move the school is out of their hands. They're arriving in a new environment where they have to start reintroducing themselves into the social fabric of the school, and that can be very challenging. What we know about adolescents is that their peer networks are very important to them, and when they get disrupted in any way, then that may cause the individual to withdraw. So if we've got a bundle of things that relates to socioeconomics, that relates to student and family mobility, then a fine placed in that kind of household isn't going to resolve the issue. And it's going to take resource away from households that are already possibly struggling in the current environment.
The government has set a target of 80% of students being present for more than 90% of the term by 2030. Do you think that this could be achievable?
Yes, I think it could. But the 90% per term challenge is quite high. It's interesting that an estimate of school attendance is that about 85% of our students are attending on any given day. Now that's quite a laudable figure, I think. If we're taking 90% attendance over an entire term, and terms are 10 weeks long, then a student only has to be absent due to a single illness, and possibly COVID might be one of those, or a winter flu. A student only has to be absent for more than 5 days to fall below that target. So again, I would be really keen to interrogate the figures that lie behind the, you know, those overall attendance rates, and to look at how many kids are routinely in school on a day-to-day basis. The term-by-term measure might be sending us in the wrong direction slightly.
What measures would you recommend to the government to perhaps reduce barriers that might be preventing children from attending school?
Well, I think it's economic resource for many people. In many parts of the media, in January and February, there are quite significant column inches, or however we measure the media's contribution these days, devoted to the cost of school uniforms, about how it forms a barrier to people returning to school for the new academic year. So economic resource can be a considerable stumbling block. I know from a colleague recently retired from a school in a low socioeconomic area in the Hawke's Bay that in the harvest season, kids go missing for quite long periods of time because they are out labouring in the workforce to bring money into the household. So our view of what might cause absenteeism has to be a very broad one, and we have to be prepared to engage in quite a lot of complexity in order to resolve the issue overall, I think.
I also spoke to Senior Lecturer in Education and Social Work at the University of Auckland, Dr. John Finnerty, about how we can make school a more inclusive space that is safe for LGBTQIA+ students. Here is that interview. First of all, what are your thoughts on the government's proposal to increase school attendance?
I'm really grateful that the government is thinking about school attendance. We know that educational achievement is really important for people's well-being. It's one thing we don't actually think about, but getting a high quality education actually improves your adult well-being. So the impacts of schools and educational achievement can't be underestimated. And what I'm also interested to see, though, is how we think about this equitably. How do we ensure that everyone is getting the benefits that should come from having good school achievement?
So we've seen recently at Buller High School in the South Island, students have said that LGBTQIA+ students are being bullied relentlessly and that they don't feel supported by their school. Could you speak to what impact bullying in particular against minority students can have on attendance?
The impact on attendance for bias-related bullying, so that's being bullied on some aspect of your personality, is significant. And that's because there's bullying that can occur for a range of factors, but when there's something that's actually about a part of your identity, that probably also means that there's aspects of the school culture and the broader culture that suggest that those elements of someone's life are not valuable, are in fact actually things that should be punished out of existence. And that means that those schools become unsafe, and obviously when people are faced with unsafe situations, it's not a big leap to think that they'll do whatever they can to avoid being unsafe. And that's where we see some of the issues around a lack of school attendance, when schools become essentially places that are dangerous. So there's sometimes critique about whether or not schools have a role to play in well-being, and we're all mindful that schools are asked to do more and more things. But schools, as a mandated place for young people to go, can absolutely produce negative consequences if people are being subjected to violence or intimidation, or simply being told that they're worthless, which essentially is what we might be seeing happening in that case in Buller High School.
Yeah, we've also seen discussion from the government about reforming gender and sexuality education in schools. Do you have any concerns around this?
I absolutely have major concerns around this because essentially when we're thinking about bias-related bullying, we're thinking about bullying that is grounded in prejudices that society holds, that people hold, that make particular people targets if they sit outside of the norm. We know in Aotearoa New Zealand there is a very strong hetero norm, there's a very strong cis norm, the idea that people will have the same gender as that was ascribed to them when they were born. And because those norms are so pervasive and so destructive, if we don't have education that actually provides a tiny slither of intervention to kind of think about actually gender and sexuality exist on a spectrum, a range of identities are not only expected but are valuable and useful. If we don't have any ability to kind of talk to the natural variation that exists in these spaces, it means that young people who occupy those identities become particularly vulnerable in schools. And the point of the relationships and sexuality education guidelines really was to provide some support for schools to start intervening in the context that produce kind of exclusionary environments for these young people. So the idea that we might remove, you know, a very thin layer of protection is really distressing because really there's not a lot else that's there for schools unless you're lucky enough to go to a school that is super proactive, super inclusive and is thinking about how all members of the school community can be welcomed and can thrive. And it doesn't sound like we're seeing that particularly strongly in some schools.
And what would your message to parents be who may have concerns or may not understand the reason behind inclusive gender and sexuality education, but want to learn more so that they can support their child or so that they can understand why this needs to be taught in schools?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And parents and whānau always want to do the best for their children. And there can be a lot of moral panic. There's always been a lot of moral panic that exists around gender and sexuality in relation to children and young people with sort of ideas that these ideas can be, these identities can be contagious. And first of all, it's really important to make it clear that that isn't the case, that people don't simply become LGBTQIA+ because they heard about it in school. What's really important then, though, is to recognise that a sizeable proportion of young people will be. The research that we've conducted in Aotearoa New Zealand suggests that at least 1 in 10 young people will occupy one of these identities. So that's a huge proportion of the population that deserve to have a safe and equitable and thriving experience at school. So for those parents that would be concerned about this, I would ask them to think about the young people that deserve to have a positive, fair experience at school in relation to their own concerns about whether or not this is too early for children to be learning about, or there's sometimes suggestions that these topics ruin people's innocence. I think that is also about kind of starting to open up a question around why we think being LGBT is somehow innocent or bad, or not innocent and therefore bad. When we create opportunities for people to think critically about where they've developed some of these negative attitudes, often they realise that some of these beliefs aren't grounded in fact. Sometimes there's been things that have simply been handed down over generations. We live in an incredibly heteronormative, homophobic and transphobic society. I can't count the amount of times I've been on public transport where I've heard young people throwing the word gay around as a slur, even today. We've seen rainbow pride crossings being painted over. We've seen firebombing. So the idea that one little bit of inclusive education is the end of the world in a context where queer people and trans people are facing fundamental kind of sustained negativity about their identities, I think is also something that we need to question. So those will be some of my things. And then, you know, specifically, if you're looking for more support, and there's amazing support out there, Rainbow Youth has a great website, Inside Out has a great website, and there's also specific resources for people that are parenting trans and non-binary children or who are in those spaces. And all of those sites are places that will give you some helpful resources. Outline is also available for people that are wondering themselves if they may be part of these communities or if they're supporting young people that are part of these communities too.
If students aren't getting comprehensive sex education, what information can you share about where students might be getting that information from anyway and how accurate that might be?
Great question. And we know that from the Identify survey where we asked 4,800 Takatāpui and Rainbow young people about their experiences getting sexuality education, overwhelming, you know, like 9 out of 10 of them say they didn't get anything decent anyway from school. This is before any repeal of any, you know, more inclusive guidelines. So the majority of the time, if we don't have teachers that are well supported and educated to deliver sexuality and relationship education, most young people, I suspect, are getting this information online. They're getting it from their peers. And that will come with some varying levels of quality as well. And so the ideal situation would be that we would have inclusive, comprehensive relationships and sexuality education that was delivered by trained teachers who were able to really lean into some of this stuff. Because expecting parents and whānau to kind of pick up the slack, so it's really difficult. You know, and often there's a lot of people's own experiences that need to be teased out in relation to some of these things. And there's no easy way to really teach about consent except by really fostering good critical thinking. And that's what schools are ideally well suited to do. What we really want to do is see them empowered to give this the time in the curriculum that we need. Traditionally, and this government in particular has really emphasised the importance of reading, writing and arithmetic as key skills. But it's also clear that, you know, if you want to be a productive member in society, you also need to know how to work with difference, work with people who are different to you. You also need to know how to be positive in relationship to others. So we'd also like to see, I think, a stronger emphasis on how we support young people to learn about what it means to be a good friend, how to be a good romantic partner, if that's something that they want to do. And that's stuff that I think we'd get really productive kind of youth out of, some decent relationships and sexuality education time in schools. I think just to really emphasise that idea that, you know, when people talk about the basics and they talk about reading, writing and arithmetic, there is a basic before that, and that is school is safe and supportive for all students. And that's something that all school boards under our Education Act are legislated to provide. So if you're in a school where you are not safe and supportive, or if you're looking after tamariki or a young person that is not safe and supported, that is actually an issue for the school board. And that's something that I would encourage you to raise with the school board. All school boards want to do their best, but sometimes they get overwhelmed by these things, and it's easy to kind of be drawn into, you know, policy initiatives around an hour of maths and an hour of writing. But if that's happening in a context where people are being demoralised and bullied, it's not going to produce the outcomes that we want. I think also one thing that I'd like to note is that when we talk about bullying, sometimes it's easy to think about bullying as simply those kind of violent acts in children being hit, but actually bullying also includes any experiences that are designed to harm someone intentionally, and that includes when people isolate and prevent people from being part of peer groups. And what that does is it stops them being able to develop themselves as a person. And that can be hard to claim as bullying if we have this idea that bullying is only this aggressive, violent act. So I'd also encourage parents to kind of check in and see with young people about what their experiences are like, and also to legitimate those experiences of being isolated and withdrawn as important. And sometimes the research shows that actually that relational form of bullying is more likely to be associated with distress than actually the kind of physical forms, which feels counterintuitive until you think about the whole point of adolescence is to develop your identity, and you develop your identity by being in relationship with others. So those would be some of my ideas, is to really listen to young people, listen to their experiences, and to legitimate the harm that's done to them if they are being bullied.
That was Dr. Brian Marsh, as well as Dr. John Finnerty from the University of Auckland Education and Social Work Faculty, on how the government can ensure students are attending school.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.